Let's talk about God and Noah and their relationship to each other and their relationship to the flood. First, I'd like to talk about a couple of theological head scratchers, some verbal puzzles that we have to work through concerning God and his attitude about the flood and Noah and his righteousness. And I'd also like to talk about covenants, God's covenant with Noah, and God's ultimate judgment. First off, the theological head scratcher. We find this in Genesis chapter 6, verse 6. I'm reading from the NIV. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, etc., and so forth. And the question that arises is, did God make a mistake? You know, the ESV puts it that the Lord was sorry. If God is sorry and grieved and filled with pain, did he make some kind of mistake in having created humanity? So that's the question. Did God make a mistake? Did God err in creating humanity, and is he imperfect for having made an error? Because that is the conjecture that some would make with this passage. But I would say that a feeling of sorrow is not the same as having made a mistake. One could feel sorry without having erred or done something incorrect that he should not have done. Now, if you don't believe this, then you ought to look at your wife the next time that she watches some, you know, romantic tragedy, some dramatic work on television. She will cry, but that does not mean that she regrets watching it. A person can feel sorrow and not regret the action that they have taken. And I think that this is what we have to look at with God. God feels sorrow for his creation, but he does not have to repent of the sin of having created them. God is perfect and is without sin. Who was Noah? And what is it about Noah that makes him the person whom God chooses to redeem or to save these animals and these people out of the flood? If we look at the King James Version of Genesis chapter 6, verse 9, it tells us that Noah was perfect. If we look in the NIV, we see that he was blameless. So, what kind of person was Noah? Was Noah literally, actually perfect? Well, to figure out, we have to go back and look at the Hebrew. The word in Hebrew is tamaim, and it suggests that Moses was without blemish. What does it mean to be without blemish? The word is most commonly used in the Old Testament to refer to the sacrificial system. The people were supposed to bring a lamb which was without blemish. So if Noah was without blemish, as a sacrificial lamb is without blemish, does that mean that Noah was literally perfect? Well, what would we say about the lamb? Is the lamb, just because it is without spots, literally perfect? I think the reality is that nothing is literally perfect. Noah died just like anyone else died, and literally perfect things don't die. Noah still had an imperfect nature, which he inherited from Adam. We also understand by his actions that Noah was not perfect. Noah was certainly good in his actions relative to his culture, but we see in Genesis chapter 9 that Noah was drunk and in his tent. Well, is passing out drunk and nude in a tent perfect behavior? I don't think that we would call that perfect behavior. So, seeing that Noah was not perfect in the English sense of the word, I'd like to present a couple of different options about how we handle this. Some have suggested that Noah was perfect in that he was genetically pure. They argue that Noah was a rare person whose lineage had not been corrupted by the mix between the sons of God and the daughters of men. And this is a possible solution, but it seems undesirable to me. Noah's fathers, including Methuselah, who, remember, Methuselah apparently died in the flood, would also have to have been perfect in this way. So why kill them and not Noah. Noah also might be perfect by comparison. We might say that he is simply relatively perfect. This doesn't really convey the English sense of the word perfect, but maybe it does, the Hebrew word tamaim. Compared to his culture, Noah was relatively unblemished, but this also seems like a little bit of an overreach to me. Like we're saying, well, we don't necessarily like what the word says when it says perfect and without blemish, so we're going to just make it relative. And I don't really like that as a solution, but it's possible. I think a better solution is to say that Noah was made perfect by sacrifice. Now, follow me here. I'm not saying that Noah's work of offering sacrifices made him perfect. So let me explain. Noah was not inherently perfect. We know this. But he offered sacrifices by faith in God. And so he had righteousness imputed to him. See, we know that sacrifices existed at this time because Abel and Cain had offered sacrifices generations ago. Sacrifices are something that people have always done in relationship to God. Noah also knew of clean and unclean animals because he was ordered to bring more of the clean animals onto the boat with him. And he made sacrifices himself immediately following the flood. We read about that in Genesis chapter 9. So we know that sacrifices were a part of Noah's life and his faith and relationship to God. You know, Noah is listed as a man of faith right next to Abel in Hebrews chapter 11. And perhaps it's because of his similarity to Abel. Abel had faith and offered a good sacrifice. Maybe Noah did as well. We understand that Christ's righteousness is imputed to us because of Christ's sacrifice, and that Christ's sacrifice is the ultimate sacrifice for sins. We read in Hebrews that the animal sacrifices were not perfect, but in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 14, we read, "For by one sacrifice, he being Christ, has made perfect forever those who are being made holy." So we understand that Christ offers a great sacrifice that makes us perfect, not because we're perfect of ourselves, but because his righteousness is imputed to us, meaning that when God looks at us, in spite of our imperfections, he sees perfections. So we are perfect in God's eyes. And that's the ultimate sacrifice which Noah looked forward to. We know that Noah's sacrifices were inferior, but prior to Christ's death, God accepted those sacrifices for sins, as he ultimately would accept Christ's sacrifice. These sacrifices were a shadow of things to come, but perhaps God credited Noah with perfection, just as he does us, because of his faith and his faithfulness in sacrifice. I think this leads us to another question, which is, where does Noah's faith come from? Why does Noah have such a strong belief in a culture which is so rotten? Well, the passage tells us. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 8 of the King James, we have the nail hit on the head in the translation here, which says, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." God had given grace to Noah. Grace, incidentally, is not needed by a person who is perfect of their own merits. Grace is needed by a person who is imperfect. But God gave Noah grace. And since Noah had that grace, he was gifted with faith. Faith is the result of God's grace in our life. So the passage tells us in verse 8 that God gave him grace. And by verse 9, it tells us that he's perfect in his ways. We know that he was a man of great faith. Hebrews tells us that. So God gave him grace. The result was faith. And that faith resulted in following God, probably through sacrifice. And those sacrifices were the shadow of Christ's imputed righteousness. So I think that that's the best solution for understanding how it was that Noah was perfect in his generation. So then, having covered our little theological head scratcher. We can move on to the bulk of the message, which is God's covenant. So, what is a covenant? A covenant is like a contract. Covenants were well known in all of human history. Two people will come together, they will covenant to do a thing, and they will strike hands and pledge, and then they will do the thing. We still do this, obviously, in the modern day. God makes covenants throughout the Bible, which are of a slightly different kind. You see, because God is sovereign, meaning because God is the ultimate power, the other party doesn't have to agree to the covenant. God simply dictates the terms, and the other party to the covenant must conform. Now, who else was involved in some of these covenants? There was a covenant made with Abraham, right? God promises to be his God and to give him descendants and give him a good land. And he makes a covenant with Isaac and Jacob, of course, after Abraham. He makes a covenant with the people of Israel at Mount Sinai, in which he says, if you obey my laws, then you'll be my people, you'll have the land. He makes a covenant with David. All right, so there are covenants throughout the Old Testament, throughout the Bible, where God promises to do something, whether positive or negative, and sometimes that thing is contingent on something that another person ought to do for him. Sometimes there is no contingency. God will simply do it, regardless of the other person's actions or attitude. And regardless of whether or not that person is going to conform to the terms of the covenant, God makes the covenant, and the people simply must comply or not comply, and God will do as he sees fit. He's not bound by us. Now, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, conform to the style of an ancient suzerain treaty, okay? So, what is a treaty of this kind? These ancient suzerain treaties were, let's put it in simple terms, suppose that a king conquers an area of land, and the people in that area of land. He would march in, he would say, I have conquered, and I am the master, and as the master, you are to submit to the terms that I dictate to you, and here is what I would have you to do, and if you will do it, then you will live, and if you don't do it, then you will be destroyed. And so the people had no choice but to conform to the standards and the dictates of the suzerain and the suzerain treaty. And the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, conform to the style of these treaties. In the first part, we have Genesis, which is a narrative that says, here is what happened leading up to the treaty. Then we have the law, which is the terms of the treaty, what the people are supposed to do. And so there are terms of the treaty. There are things that God will do for us and things that we must do for him. There is also a sign that accompanies the covenant, and covenants often come with a sign. We've talked about the sign that was given to Cain when God made a promise to Cain that he would not be killed, right? And so signs come in God's covenants as well throughout the Bible, and the sign is just a symbol that reminds the parties of the covenant and the terms of the covenant, and it also proves the ratification of the covenant. It's kind of like the signed document that we would have today that proves that both parties agreed to the terms. The sign of the covenant is that kind of proof. So let's talk about what happened specifically in this covenant. What were the terms of the covenant? First off, God promised not to curse the ground, right? We see this, we're looking now in Genesis chapter 8, the end of chapter 8, starting at verse 20 and going through the middle of chapter 9 through verse 17. God promised not to curse the ground, not to destroy every living creature, not to catastrophically disrupt the normal functioning of the planet, and not to flood the entire earth. Okay? Those are, just in short, the things that God promised in this covenant. And in exchange, God made some demands. He demanded that Noah and his descendants never eat blood, and he also demanded that Noah and his descendants not shed an innocent man's blood, but that they must shed the blood of a blood shedder. Now, talking specifically about eating blood, I want to make note that this command remained in effect in the Mosaic Law in Leviticus chapter 17. You can read about that. And the command is still viable today. In Acts chapter 15, the Jerusalem Council affirmed that eating blood is not appropriate for believers. So we see this throughout the Bible, and again, Noah, we understand, is a representative of all humanity. If Noah was commanded not to eat the blood and his sons were commanded not to eat the blood, then we are commanded not to eat the blood. Now, does that mean that we have to eat only kosher meats? I would think that that's not the case. What the Bible dictates in terms of not eating the blood is a little bit different than what kosher Jews today might advocate means not eating the blood. The standard is simply that when something is killed to be eaten, that its blood is dumped out on the ground. I think part of the point is that the thing is completely dead because it makes so much point that the life is in the blood. So you make sure that the thing is completely dead, you don't eat it while it's still alive, and you you dump as much of it as you can. There's no process that will ever take every single, you know, red blood cell out of a creature's flesh. So if someone tells you that they've come up with that process, they are lying, more than likely, and you will never get rid of all the blood. But a good faith effort to spill the blood, you know, pour it out on the ground instead of eating it is, in my understanding, sufficient. And so those are the things that God promised, those are the things that God demanded, and this is the sign of the covenant. God has put his rainbow in the clouds. Now, the rainbow today has been unfortunately hijacked by some groups that support some very unbiblical positions, some people who would not really be interested in God's covenants. But the rainbow is a symbol to us that God will keep his promises and that he will not flood the earth. Now, there will ultimately be an end of the earth. Right here at the end of chapter 8, we see that God says, while the earth remains, these are the terms of this covenant. Ultimately, however, there will be an end of the earth. If we were to look at Revelation chapter 21, verse 1, and I'm going to flip to it here. All right, Revelation 21, verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. So the world will ultimately pass away. We have that certain. We know it. So God has promised, though, that there will never be a flood to destroy the earth. And so there will not be a flood like this one to destroy the earth. But the flood serves as a precursor of God's ultimate judgment. And we know that God will judge the earth. Consider, for instance, Matthew chapter 24, verses 36 through 40. I'm going to read from the NIV, where God describes his judgment, or Jesus describes the judgment. He says, "No one knows about the day or hour, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be left in the field. One will be taken and the other left." So Jesus compared the coming end of the world to the flood, particularly in terms of its timing and the suddenness with which it comes on the earth. We understand also that this destruction of the earth will come not by water, but by fire. In 2 Peter verses 3 through 7, I'm sorry, 2 Peter chapter 3 verses 3 through 7, he wrote, "In the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, 'Where is the coming he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation.' But they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. By these waters also, the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men." So, we have it said that the world will not be destroyed by flood, but we know certainly that the world will ultimately be destroyed by fire, and that the ungodly will experience this. So then, what have we learned here? We know that God keeps his promises. In this story, he gives his first laws to mankind, insisting that they not eat blood and that they do justice. And in exchange, he promises not to destroy the world by flood, but ultimately to destroy the heavens and the earth by flame.